listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Well, welcome once again to Full Power Living, the only show on international media dedicated to the exploration and understanding of emotions and their role in human life. I'm Eileen Dillon, your show creator and host. Have you thought much about what really runs your life? What's the basis on which you make decisions or take risks, accept who you really are, or achieve brilliant success? Today we're looking at the story and life of a beautiful woman, amazingly talented and highly successful, yet with a life that ended prematurely. How could the brilliant Whitney Houston have so lost her way, given that at one time she had amassed a fortune of $240 million, was recognized as a fantastic performer, and was loved by millions of people? A lot of people say it was Bobby Brown or drugs. My guests today say it was loyalty and allegiance. Loyalty and allegiance could be creating difficulties in your life, too, so listen up. My guests today are a formidable husband-wife team of PhD psychologists who've been fascinated with the susceptibility we all have to out-of-awareness patterns that block our ability to integrate and enjoy success, what they call holdbacks. In fact, they have a 12-CD program on overcoming the fear of being fabulous. Judith Shervin and Jim Snikowski, known best as Judith and Jim, specialize in helping people in all areas of life to confront, understand, and release unconscious prohibitions against success. So they want you and coaches and therapists and teachers and medical professionals and parents and grandparents and everybody to understand the power of unconscious loyalty, what they call the love grip, allegiances and forbiddances, the ideas that we're exploring today as we talk about the tragic outcome of the most promising life of Whitney Houston. As guest experts, they're best-selling authors. They've published 6 books. They've appeared on over 2,700 TV and radio shows, and their work has been published in numerous magazines and newspapers as well. They met on a blind date in 1987 and married 13 months later, so it's my pleasure to have them here today. Judith and Jim, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you, Eileen, and what a wonderful introduction. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Eileen. Pleasure to be with you.
Great. Well, now let's get right down to it. Whitney Houston had every possibility of having a long, glamorous, successful, and profitable career. And instead, she had a fabulous career for a short while, and then she started encountering difficulties like abuse in a marriage and drug addiction, and died at the age of 48. What was it in particular about Whitney's story that grabbed your attention and led you to write your book on what really killed Whitney Houston?
First of all, exactly what you detailed, Eileen, which is that she had everything. She had the looks, she had the talent, she had a 5-octave voice, she had won more awards than any female star singer in the world. She had everything. So there's no way we could look at her and say, well, if only she'd been smarter, if only she had been more attractive, whatever. But nevertheless, something internal took her down into that horrible world of drug addiction and abuse. So when she died at 48, it was very clear. And we were not followers of Whitney's. Neither Jim nor I were really fans of hers, although, of course, we would see the headlines when she would fall apart and be in trouble again. And so we thought, yes, her story must hold all of the elements that we know are true for so many people in terms of the fear of really being fabulous in your own life and the fear of changing your identity and owning who you rightfully are, different from how you were raised. And indeed, all the research we did proved that we were right.
Wow. That's no small task. I pretty well have accomplished that in my life, but I'm 71 now. So it took me a long time, and it's a huge task to extract yourself from what you grew up with. And I know you talk about unconscious patterning. It starts even before you're born. And then find out who you are separate from all of that. Often I tell people, listen, you're living your life based on what a very small handful of the nearly 7 billion people on this planet have told you about yourself. And that's not necessarily true.
Well, you know, in the psychological world, the idea of the self is one of the premier ideas. And in the therapeutic world, people talk about, you know, discovering yourself, uncovering yourself, doing all of that. But Eileen, precisely what you've said is the self, whatever that is, the self is not easy to either uncover or invent. And I frankly think it's a combination of both. Because I do not think that the self is sort of hiding behind your pancreas, ready to be discovered. And I also think it's invented largely. However, the reason it's so difficult is, first of all, you have to know there's a problem. And not a behavioral problem, but an existential problem. A problem at the level of your being, not just at the level of your behavior. Then, or say it another way, less philosophic, at the level of your identity versus the level of your behavior. And then you have to go about the search. And we have spent a lot of years in the therapeutic community, and a lot of therapists don't do this. A lot of therapists, and I would say probably the majority, go after behavior change, there's nothing wrong with that. But to go after identity shifting is an entirely different story. And the problem with Whitney was that her identity was shaped early on
in New Jersey.
And she never left what we call she never left home. And by that, it doesn't mean that she didn't move out of New Jersey. It means she did not become aware of the patterns and the internal commitments, unconscious commitments she'd made to beliefs and relationships and attitudes that actually shaped who she was. And so what happened is the success was there. She was young. She was young and beautiful, and all of that began to happen. But what ultimately happens is that the unconscious structures begin to emerge to the surface. And if you're not aware of that or not prepared for it, they can and will take you down, depending upon what they are, like they did her. And when you say you're 71, by the way, we're 72 and 70, so we've been around about the same amount of time as you have.
Yes, we have, yeah.
It's a task. But again, there's one last element. The task is a spiritual, deeply psychological task. And most people spend their lives just getting through the day, doing their jobs and whatever. So that you have, that you have done it, it points to who you are, and most people do not go the path that you're describing.
Yes, I know. I felt very alone many times. I want to make a couple of comments. I don't know if you're aware that I have worked as, I'm a clinical social worker, and I've worked as a psychotherapist for 41 years now, and I want to just emphasize what you've said there, which is I agree with you that most therapists and psychologists, no matter what you are, they are helping people adjust to life as opposed to shifting their perception of themselves. And when you help people shift the perception of themselves, they make lasting change.
Right. So, yes.
That's really a key thing. And so anybody who's listening, if you get to a therapist who's helping you just make surface changes, go somewhere else. Go keep finding
people. Absolutely.
Yeah, so I want to say that. And the other thing I want to ask you is you said, well, they have to know there's a problem. What are the clues that there's a problem?
First of all, any long-standing dissatisfaction with your life, whether it's in your love life, your physical health, your work, your financial standing, if there is a long-standing dissatisfaction, that's certainly a key. If you are chronically depressed, I don't mean seriously depressed like you need medication. I don't think most people who are depressed need medication. In fact, I think some of the medication can be very destructive. But if you're depressed and unhappy, or you're anxious all the time, those are clues that something is out of balance for who you really are. And just to give you an example of somebody who wrote us recently who had read our book, What Really Killed Whitney Houston, and woke him up to the fact that he had been granted a full-on scholarship after high school, and two other universities provided half scholarships. He turned them all down. He has a common kind of name like John Smith. He believed they must have gotten their records confused because it couldn't possibly be him. He came from a background that demanded that he stay home to take care of his mother and siblings on the wrong side of the tracks, and has lived his life underachieving all of these years. And finally, in reading What Really Killed Whitney Houston, the alarm bells went off and he went, I have to change who I am, how I live, and how my marriage is going, who he loves his wife dearly, because I've been trapped in these old beliefs all these years.
I mean, and from a tactical perspective, the idea of repetitive behaviors is significant. And to use an example that may sound trivial over and against Whitney's death, but it really isn't, all of us know of people who say they want to go on a diet. And they claim to the high heavens that this is precisely and exactly what they're going to do. They're committed and determined. And then they start eating donuts. Well, that's not weakness. That's not a weakness. What it is, it's a commitment to something that's more important than actually accomplishing the diet. And that commitment to what's more important, that which is more important, lies in the unconscious. And if the person really, successfully wants to a diet is not just a matter of losing a pounds. A diet is becoming someone else. And that's where the unconscious commitments come into play and actually forbid you, not in some dictatorial sense, but habitually and behaviorally forbid you to go in directions that are contrary.
Wow, that's intense. Okay, so I know you outline this in your book, but for our listeners, describe more what you're talking about these unconscious patterns. They can actually begin in the womb, as I understand from reading, and I know they involve the development of beliefs and they involve your environment. What is this unconscious magnet, if you will?
Absolutely, Eileen. For everyone listening, think about what happens when the sperm and the egg join together in a woman's womb. The growth of that little person starts immediately. And inside, the biochemical and emotional environment of that woman and wherever she's living. So if she is depressed, that little being is absorbing the biochemistry and the emotional atmosphere of depression. If she is anxious, the same thing. If she's joyous, the same thing. If she's at peace with life, the same thing. Meanwhile, in the first 3 months of that little baby's, little zygote to begin with, the fundamental brain structure is developing. As the baby grows, and in the second trimester, then the more sophisticated mammalian midbrain, I'm not going to go into brain chemistry here too much, but the brain is forming, and finally in the final trimester, the more sophisticated part of the brain is beginning to form. So the brain of each baby is forming in an atmosphere of that mother's biochemistry and the world that she's living in. Babies can hear in the womb. So if mom and dad are screaming at each other all the time, if fighting is going on, the baby is absorbing that this is not a safe place. In fact, it's a violent place. It's a dangerous place. On the other hand, parents who rub the pregnant belly and speak to their baby lovingly and play beautiful music, it's been proven that the baby's absorbing that. So And that's all unconscious. That baby cannot in any way, shape, or form say, yes, I like this world. I want it to stay this way. I'm going to make it more, you know, make more of it. Or I don't like this. I don't like people screaming. I'm not going to join those folks. I'm going to find some other family to go into. Impossible. The baby is born with only one quarter of the brain weight that it will have as an adult, and that brain has to keep developing, 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 and not until that child is about seven can it begin to make any kinds of evaluations about the world that it is growing up in. So all of those early years of experience is being housed in the unconscious mind of that child.
Mm-hmm. And I would add, too, that my learning is that messages that are repeated, sometimes they can be picked up from the parents, but messages that are repeated over and over again in your early life go right into the subconscious and are taken in as truth. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Totally.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so it's certainly when a parent or an aunt, an uncle, grandparent is saying, you're never going to amount to much, or I wish you weren't around. You're really you bother me.
Or the simple fact that there was a study done at UCLA that a child at one before they're 1 year old, they hear the word no 300 to 400 times a day or a month. I can't remember
a
what
day. A day,
but an immense number of times. Now, it's understandable because if someone's one and they're beginning, they finally stand and they're beginning to toot around or whatever, and you got to be able to say, no, you can't do that or watch out for that because they may do something that's destructive to them. Nevertheless, that all goes in as no. So mm-hmm. That's rather suppressive of any kind of exploratory and adventuresome an adventuresome context.
Okay, so now what happened with Whitney is she had all of this. She grew up in the projects in New Jersey. Her mother was a Grammy Award-winning, Sissy mm-hmm. Houston, a Grammy Award-winning soul singer. Dionne Warwick was part of the family too, I believe.
And aunt, yes, uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
It's a cousin. She was a cousin.
Oh, well, so she had these kind of different things, but a lot of what went into her subconscious is what you say she remained loyal to all of her life that actually pulled her away from being the fabulous person she could have continued to be.
Exactly. And I'm going to give you a template that I think will make it easy to understand. Just think of any person in your life, including yourself. We are born into this world, and we are what we do in the early years of our life is just absorb. We pick up everything. Like, for example, learning a language. There's no language school for a one-year-old. We just absorb it. We just pick it up. And, of course, there are systems within us that are ready to pick it up so it absorbs, not unlike a sponge absorbs water. Then we absorb all of that environment. If the environment, for example, is ambitious, ambition can become part of who you are. If the environment is frightened or depressed, that becomes part of who you are because we indiscriminately absorb what's around us as reality. And because we are infants and toddlers, there's no internal mechanism that's discriminatory such that we can say, no, I don't think that's right. I have a different opinion. We just absorb it. That is then assumed to be reality. And who in their right mind would question reality? Reality is reality. It's real. It's what is. When in fact, what it is the absorption of the environment of our early years. Then what we do is we go forward in life and we build internal institutions, beliefs, desires, fears, objectives, goals, etc. And they are based, if physically we can assume that that reality absorption is the basement, the others are beginning to be built on the first floor. And they're built within and expressing that foundational sense of reality. When in fact that reality is only specific to you and where you come from. They can be generalized. I mean, you know, like houses can be, a great many houses can have a depressed feeling, but specifically it's your reality. then
the floors of your house
can be built on top of that, and there's never ever a question about what reality is. So what you're building on is assumed to be absolute, when in fact it's only specific to you. Once you begin to things begin not to work, people go to therapists and say, "What's going on in my life? It's not working anymore." And at that time you begin to unpeel Freud's onion. You begin to take it apart, and you go down to discover, at least with some therapists, you go down to discover that foundational basement identity that you thought was overall real, and in fact it's only yours.
Wow. And Eileen and everyone listening, when we look at the fact that, yes, Cissy Houston did have her own Grammy Award, but Cissy sang backup for stars like Aretha Franklin. She was not a star in her own right. She was also not an attractive, physically attractive woman. Whitney Houston was glamorously beautiful beyond measure. And the mother also was I believe still today, the choir director at a Baptist church in New Jersey, where there was a lot of messaging about Satan and sin, and Whitney absorbed that. As well as when Whitney wins her first Grammy Award, and the mother, Cissy Houston, is interviewed, and the video is online, the mother doesn't say, "I'm so proud of her, she's so sensational, she's going to have a magnificent career, I'm so..." No, the mother says, "Yes, she's my little baby. I still remember her in pigtails. She's my one and only little baby." Mm. So the mother's message is, "I'm not letting go of her. She is going to be my baby forever."
Mm-hmm. And she was. And that's really very interesting. I want to hear more of where that took Whitney. We know ultimately where it took her, but we're up for our first break right now. So we're talking with Judith Shervin and Jim Snikowski, who are both PhD psychologists, and they are the authors of What Really Killed Whitney Houston. So we're going to be talking about unconscious loyalties and forbiddances when we come back after this break. You're listening to Full Power Living. How would you parent your child if he or she were a foreign exchange student? As a host for an exchange student, you'd have 5 main jobs to do. Those are the same 5 jobs important in raising kids. People around the world have used this approach to raise kids who are self-directed, make great decisions, and are immune to peer pressure. Get your copy of The Exchange Student Model for Parenting, written by me, Eileen Dillon, now available on Kindle. As a 41-year marriage and family therapist, a single, married, step, adoptive, and grandmother, I've got a thing or two to tell you that's going to lighten your load as a parent and help you create incredible kids who will become amazing adults. Go to Kindle.com and download The Exchange Student Model for Parenting today. Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. Full Power Living and all of our programs is available through subscription on iTunes. We broadcast live every Thursday from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time over Blog Talk Radio and on EmotionalPro.com. And our shows are archived both places for 6 weeks so that you have time to listen to them. Next week on January 16th, film director Ted Nicolau will be here. He's going to be talking about Finding Happiness, a film he made on one spiritually oriented community that was formed to explore whether people really can live lovingly and supportively together. We're going to be talking about community, and Paramahansa Yogananda was the inspiration for the creation of that community. So we'll talk a little bit about his influence as well. It's a great way to explore the power of emotions and I want to thank you again for helping us with our mission of raising awareness of the power and importance of human emotions. Today, I'm talking with best-selling authors and executive coaches, Judith and Jim, about the ideas in their new book, What Really Killed Whitney Houston. We'd love to hear your comments and questions. Call now, 888-498-0570. You can also leave questions on our chat, 888-498-0570. Now, before we stopped, you were talking about the statement from Whitney's mother that she was her baby, Judith. And
And
a big part of the message that you have in What Really Killed Whitney Houston is that Whitney never grew up. Like you were talking about, Jim, she never developed a sense of herself. It was more like she was her mom and dad's baby and God's child, but not herself.
Correct. Yes, exactly. When she would win awards, she would routinely thank mommy and daddy. Now think, this is a woman in her, at this point now, late 20s, thanking mommy and daddy, not even mom and dad, and thanking Jesus Christ and God, but had a very, very difficult time accepting the praise for herself.
Mm-hmm. Well, so we can stand outside of Whitney Houston and see that she's beautiful, that she had a wonderful voice. I know she herself felt that her mother had a better voice and just couldn't be. Her mother didn't have a 5-octave range, for example. So all of us, we can't see the things about ourselves either. Why can't we see who we really are?
Well, again, as what I said earlier, Eileen, we take it for granted as reality. And why would you question reality? I look outside my window. There's a plot of land with some trees and leaves having fallen to the ground. What am I going to say? That's not what's out there? Reality is reality. However, most people organize and believe the reality in a physical, external sense. Like I just said, the plant, the tree and the plot of land, etc., and I'm going to change that. But the internal reality is very, very, it's very malleable, but up to a point. I don't believe that we ever clean out in some absolute sense. All of that early stuff is always remnant and hanging around. But the reason we don't is because there's no two things. Your behavior has to get bad, your life situation has to get bad enough for you to say, wait a minute, something's going on here. Once you say that, then where do you look? Where do you go to look? As we said earlier, if you go into the therapeutic community, with no condemnation of that, but if you go there, they're going to say change your behavior. They're going to give you topical behavioral adjustments to make. But if the foundation isn't at least looked at and appreciate its existence appreciated, there's no way that really deep and long-lasting change can be made.
And to give an example, I was raised by parents who had no education. My dad had dropped out of high school in the 11th grade. My mother graduated high school, but that was it. They were not ambitious people. They hadn't come from families that were ambitious. And so I was not raised with ambition. Quite the contrary, I was raised to get married.
Mm-hmm.
And that sunk in. I was to get married. Everybody got married. All my aunts and uncles were married. Everybody was getting married. But meanwhile, I grew up in Los Angeles. I won a beauty contest when I was 12 and looked 18 and fell into modeling, fell into acting, did a number of roles, did practically 100 television commercials and then a lot of acting roles on shows like I Dream of Jeannie, Star Trek, Wild Wild West, etc. And lines with, 20 lines, not just walk-ons. It meant nothing. Why? I didn't have anything in my consciousness that said, have a career, make a lot of money. Zero. What was in my mind and what actually told me to walk away from that was I had to get married. And that is an example in a kind of simplistic form of how our minds work, that what was programmed in, you believe, what you may stumble upon later, if there's no housing for it in your identity, you leave, or you mess it up.
Because you don't belong. We use the words allegiance and forbiddance. Allegiance is a loyalty. It's a conscious or unconscious loyalty. But we're talking about the unconscious loyalty. Or, on the other hand, there's what we call forbiddance. And those are just corollaries. If I am unconsciously permitted to go to the left, then going to the right is not permitted. So we call that a forbiddance. And you can identify these issues either by checking yourself out, doing a self-inventory with respect to your behaviors over your lifetime, and look for what we call loyalties or allegiances, and or then look for forbiddances where you're not permitted to go, and then you can begin the journey down into the unconscious aspects of your own identity. And that will then, in our judgment, it's at that point that you need professional assistance, because you can really get confused and lost inside, because somebody from the outside who doesn't live within your world has to be able to look at and see what you're doing and allow you to point to it, mainly because we are all blind, given what I said earlier, that reality is reality.
And so where Whitney was concerned, she had strong allegiance both to her roots in New Jersey and to her mother and to how she thought she was supposed to be. And as you point out in your book, she didn't have room to create or to step in to the role of being the fabulous, magnificent star. She had every possibility of being and maintaining herself as.
Correct, Eileen. I'm going to just change language here just for a second. And that is, you said she didn't have room. Room is an inappropriate metaphor. She didn't have permission.
She had
all kinds of room. She had tons of money. She could have done whatever she wanted. But internally, she did not have permission, because internally, what we call holdbacks, the roadblocks, the barricades, there are all kinds of terms that can be used, but that which forbids going in a direction was far more important than her ability to see beyond that and create her own life. So in a sense, she had her own life as a performer, but she did not have her own life as a person.
There's a quote that I picked out. It is, so enmeshed was she in her loyalty, caretaking, and subservience to her family, Whitney could not own her own rightful position in her marriage, much less in the world. A lot of people tend to blame Bobby Brown, and he may bear some culpability, but what you're suggesting here is that she didn't really have permission to create a place for herself in marriage either.
Well, exactly. Growing up in Baptist and Pentecostal teachings that, particularly back then, preach that the man is the head of the household and that the woman should follow, all of the research that we did documented that she, without questioning, even though she was the superstar and he was not, she fell immediately into role of an unquestioning, dutiful, loyal wife. And again, this is at an unconscious level, is that she never questioned that kind of teaching. She did not have enough of a self to be able to say, wait, that makes no sense. Even though, for instance, she paid for their wedding, she had the fame. She could not question her role as a wife.
And that must have been supported by the fact that in her career, she was literally surrounded by all of her relatives. Her sister-in-law ran her business, and her brother handled her finances, I don't remember all the details, but people all around her were literally still running her life when she was a performer.
Right, exactly. She kept all of her family members employed and funded. People were quoted after she died. Many people were quoted as saying that they just sucked money out of her, and she was unable again to have a separate career. Even her father was the head of her business, and there's no evidence that he understood how to do business. The only person who was not employed by Whitney was the mother, Sissy, and yet Sissy insisted on being the first resource as a counselor to Whitney's life. Mm-hmm. So Whitney could never leave the advice of her mother. The mother was always there. In fact, the evidence is that even the weekend when Whitney died, the mother was on the phone over and over trying to give counsel to Whitney.
You know, Eileen, the first time that Whitney went to Europe on tour, she went on tour, and for the people who don't know show business, going on tour, you don't go alone. You go with an entire entourage, your staff and the people who set up the shows, the musicians, the backup singers. You go with a whole group of people.
Your makeup artist, your hairdresser.
All of that.
Yeah.
So you are not alone. And what she did in that first tour was she called home every night.
And she cried every day.
She called home to actually remain connected with that, what I said earlier, the unconscious foundation. She had all of these people around her. She didn't go to them for assistance. She didn't go to them. It never dawned on her, why am I so upset? Why am I needing to call home? I'm a big girl now. I can go out and have a life. And she could not break away. She could not leave home. So finally, when she came home, she spent a lot of time initially at her parents' home and going there for dinner. In other words, she was so glued. And the environment that she had grown up in was so intensely fused within her that that's who she was. So when she becomes, and also part of what happened on the with her racial relationship is she was booed on Soul Train, the first appearance on Soul Train.
The Soul Train Awards in 1989.
She was booed. And they didn't. The black community did not call her Whitney. When they were cynical, they called her Whitney. Because they wanted her to stay inside the black community. And that's another element of don't leave home, because she was beginning to become a princess for the world, not just for the black community. And she could not leave that because the draw was so intense.
Mm-hmm. But she was, as I recall, she was Dutch, Native American, and African American.
Right.
So, correct. So she could never be fully black because she wasn't, and yet there was nobody there to help her integrate and own that that reality of who she actually was.
But
and so she was quite quite brokenhearted. According to her friends, it really broke her heart that the black community would not accept her.
Well, we did a program on this show about the difficulties that mixed race kids have, that they have difficulty defying. Unless parents are very careful to help them know their roots, they have difficulty identifying with one or the other. But as I understand what you were saying in your book, if Whitney had been able to develop more of a sense of self, like, okay, so I'm not fully black, but I am me, and I have these different mixtures in me, and I can be proud of all of them, she would not necessarily have been so crushed by that response.
Quite the contrary, she could have said, I am a citizen of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I am how the world is becoming. And she could have even spoken out and said, you know, to the African-American community, this is what's holding you back. This kind of bias, this kind of judgmentalness is what's holding the African-American community back. Stop it. Don't do that. Give it up.
Well, you're
and
now...
And she could have, you know, had real leadership.
Right. Well, you're now saying that... But, you know, whether you're African-American or any other ethnic origin,
correct.
You're still holding yourself back that way. So really the message for everyone to hear is do whatever you can to stop holding yourself back.
Right, right, uh-huh. Exactly. And stop judging other people who are not exactly the way you are as being wrong.
You know, if you look at the mafia, in the movies at least, and I'm sure in reality, they say la familia, the family. And once you, the family is the center of your existence. They don't say, go out and discover who you are, or at least invent who you are, and go create a life. They say, stay close. It's the family, la familia. I know that from my experience with my Polish background. I left Detroit, and for years, my mother would say, are you coming back? And I'd say bluntly, no, mother, don't ever expect me to come back. There's nothing there for me. And she would stop in that particular phone call, for example, stop requesting, but then she would request again later because my grandparents came over from Poland. My parents were first generation. It was all about being the family. And so as a result, this is not unusual. People across all ethnic backgrounds do not leave home. People don't leave home in general because the whole notion of leaving home the way we're talking about it, not physically, not moving to Wisconsin, but to actually leave behind the roots that you have been shaped by, that's not a common notion anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, for a long time, I decried my own experience as a child because my father was in the military, and I went from pillar to post. You know, and then my parents got me to college and stopped paying for college in the middle of my first semester. And I complained about all of that, you know, and thought I'd been victimized. But when I read about Whitney, I'm thinking, well, I was saved in one sense because I got different perspectives. I didn't have to stay tied in to the to just one way of looking at things.
And also, when they stopped paying for your college, in effect, they threw you out of the house. And did you have to go on and pay for yourself?
I did, yes. And I finished a master's degree.
Wow. So first of all, congratulations.
Bravo. Yes, bravo. Yeah.
And secondly, but that was a significantly positive event in the context that we're talking about. I'm sure in the middle of it felt like hell, but it was a significantly positive event because you were forced to begin to become you as opposed to having a self in the form of the family.
Yes, yes. And your book really brought that to the fore for me. I'm going, you know, well, now I'm glad I went on, number one. And number two, look at the advantage I had because I at least wasn't tied down with that. We're up to our second break. You can get more information on Judith and Jim's websites, judithandjim.com and whatreallykilledwhitneyhouston.com. So we're going to be talking more about what it takes to break away from subconscious programming and become the fabulous people we've all come to the earth to be when we come back here on Full Power Living.
Eileen Dillon is a certified senior life mentor with Accessing Universal Intelligence. She's available to conduct mentoring sessions with you to help you understand, change, and evolve using the advice of your own higher self. You can be anywhere in the world. Sessions are conducted through Skype. For more information about these life mentoring sessions, fees, and how to register, go to www.emotionalpro.com and click on the mentoring link at the top. Get personally tailored assistance with your toughest life questions. Visit mentoring@emotionalpro.com today.
Judith Shervin and Jim Snikowski, who are authors of What Really Killed Whitney Houston, are discussing with us today how it is that each of us stops ourselves from being the fabulous person we can be on this earth. And we want to talk more about what we can do to open the door to be that fabulous person that we really are. Let me just backtrack for a second here, Judith and Jim. Whitney had plenty of money. She went to treatment programs for addictions, and yet you say that it's beyond tragic that there was no professional available to Whitney who understood the power of unconscious loyalties. How can we go so far? How is it that they missed helping her to get what she needs?
Well, according to, she was in an she had two interventions and she was in rehab. And according to Bobby Brown's sister, Tina, who was around for much of that, one, when she was in rehab, she could get drugs brought into the facility. So as best we understand, there probably was no actual real rehab in the early years. There was apparently an effective rehab in her 40s when she was making that last film, and I don't remember the title of it at the moment, but she then fell off the wagon and went back into drugs and alcohol again. The two interventions that the mother, Sissy Houston, required, the professionals were described by Tina, Bobby Brown's sister, as being so enamored of Whitney that they could not stay focused on the work at hand. They were just enamored at meeting her. So apparently there has been, there was over those years, a minimal of anyone being able to stay professionally effective. And unfortunately, as we've said, far too many professionals aren't really skilled at this level of helping people with deep unconscious loyalties.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had David Bedrick on this show. He wrote a book called Talking Back to Dr. Phil, and he had quite a bit to say about mainstream psychology. I don't know if you're familiar with his work.
No,
not, but we would probably agree with him.
Well, he said that he says that instead of exploring the underlying meanings, which is what you're talking about too, for information that could aid in personal transformation and seeing the beauty, power, and intelligence in human beings, mainstream psychology meets what disturbs people with the simple question, "What's wrong with them?" And
right.
And so the question is, if I'm in that situation and I need help, what do I need differently from the therapeutic world in order to get that help?
Well, that's a very, very good question. And the reason we say it's a very good question is because much of the work that we do, we've had to invent ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, we work now as executive coaches to corporations, and we are consultants on retainer to the company LinkedIn. And much of what we're talking about here, we see with regard to the executives and that we work with in our coaching sessions. Where do you go? Well, there have been places like the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology, or there have been what have been called spiritual psychotherapies. Got to be very careful with the notion of spiritual, because that can be a lot of hokum. But nevertheless, there are places that looked at not how to fix you, but how to transform you, how they can help you transform yourself. Because change is not about a behavior change. That's additive. If, for example, you drive too fast, and I tell you, don't drive fast, and you don't drive fast, the impulse that led to the driving fast has not been addressed, and that impulse will be expressed in some other way. Maybe you'll start eating fast or something. Mm-hmm. So there aren't a lot, and to our knowledge, to be honest, there aren't any that actually go very deep into the process of how to make identity change, simply because identity change has not been the focus of psychology. And psychology as a discipline, as a formal discipline, is only about 150 years old, roughly. So a lot of it was on the surface beginning, and there was a whole period in the United States where behavioralism was the vogue, and then that was practiced for a long time. But nevertheless, I think what I'm doing is dancing here, Eileen, because dancing around your question, because the answer is there aren't any, and you're going to have to do, people are going to have to do their own personal research to see what they can find, and then it'll be hit and miss.
Well, you know, I call myself a transpersonal therapist and have for many years, and developed or learned the notion that our Earth is a giant school and we all come here in order to learn and grow. These subconscious patterns that we're talking about, I call our homework assignments. That's what we get, that we work on for our lives. And what I have observed and what I work with the people I see and work with, are that the issues that we need to work on come up over and over again. And it's so that we can work on them and heal them and put them, graduate from them. But if we don't learn them, if we don't complete, they just keep repeating. And each time they repeat, they get harsher. It's a more difficult lesson. However, the minute we learn this lesson, we move on. And that approach has been really powerful for me and the people I work with.
Well, bravo for you, because that is a way of examining those core messages that are usually unconsciously undermining one's life happiness, life satisfaction. And I really appreciate, Eileen, that you have developed this way of helping people that digs deep into what the real issues are and helps them free themselves up to go on and live transformed lives, really transcendent lives, and bravo.
And I will say, in answer to your question directly, where can people who are looking for this kind of work, this kind of psychotherapeutic work go? Go to Eileen.
Now I set myself up for that. Sorry about that.
No, you did not.
No,
I did not, because I'm serious. When I say, Judith and I used to say over and over again, where are the therapists that can do for us what we can do for other people? And we finally, and that was a complaint and a yearning and a lament. Ultimately, we had to just accept there aren't many. And there are far and few between. If we find one, that'd be great. But we just have to press forward ourselves.
And that's why we develop the work that we do, which we call Overcoming the Fear of Being Fabulous, that in our own way does some related kinds of work that Eileen's talking about, where we dig deep into what people's unconscious programming is that they're in allegiance to, that is holding them back, or where they are forbidden to go forward that they're not even aware of. But once the illumination happens, then people start to really break free.
Yes, they do. And your approach is so culturally fitting, I think, because I think people in the U.S. anyway really would like to become fabulous. If you look at any of these singing programs, for example, everybody wants to be the fabulous star.
You know, Eileen, let me stop you there for a second, because you use the word fabulous. We use it, and we use it confidently, but we want to be very specific. We don't mean the American Idol or the Taj Mahal or being a prince or princess of some country. All we mean is that where you, all of us, and we work with executives at various highest levels, and they hit walls. So all of us hit walls, and to be fabulous simply means getting beyond that wall into the next area of your development, and then the next area and the next area, although it's not out of the question that you could be, well, you could win American Idol or you could hit the lotto or all those kinds of outrageous, but those the percentages of those are so small that they're almost insignificant, while most people have to live their lives every day.
So you're talking about becoming fabulous for yourself.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes.
The freedom to be all that you are.
I like that. That's a good place. A good place for us to stop.
Okay.
I so much appreciate you appearing on Full Power Living to talk about this fascinating, important aspect of life. And let me remind you, listeners, that the book that we've been talking about is What Really Killed Whitney Houston. And there's a website, What Really Killed WhitneyHouston.com. It's a compelling read, and it encourages you to look long and hard at how you're living your own life and to look at whether you're allowing your own fabulousness. So it's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you both. I know you have another appointment. I want to free you up to do that, but I'd love to talk for hours with you on these things. It's really great.
And vice versa, huh?
Yes, vice versa, Eileen. Thank you so very much.
It's been my pleasure. Have a good day.
Thank you very much.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So remember, next week we're taking a look at whether we can really live lovingly together in community as I talk with filmmaker and director Ted Nicolau about his film, Finding Happiness. Ananda Village was a deliberately created community. It is a deliberately created community. It started out in 1968 based on spiritual principles and understanding. And so I think it's going to be really fascinating to find out what's happened there in the last 46 years since its founding. I've been there personally myself and really enjoyed my visit. And we also interviewed about 3 years ago the now deceased founder of Ananda, Swami Kriyananda. So it will be interesting to tie things up in this way. Join me at 9 a.m. Pacific time next Thursday to investigate this with me. Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media is our producer. Thank you very much, Paul. And for now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you, pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.